This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Two more games, two more wins. Victories over Everton and Copenhagen have taken Manchester City's run to 9 in a row after the return from the Club World Cup. And the patchy form of late autumn and early winter is starting to be a distant memory. It might have been a bit of a slog against the Toffees, but it turned out to be pretty comfortable in the end in both games. A City starting to engage in their title run-in mode. We'll wait and see on that one. That's all up for discussion on today's Blue Moon podcast. Plus, there's a look ahead to the upcoming games with Chelsea and Brentford. We're on the verge of that spell of what looks like difficult games, so we'll be asking how Pep Guardiola can keep this momentum going through what could be the most challenging part of the season. We'll hear from The Athletic's Liam Toomey later on to find out what to expect from Chelsea this weekend. Plus, what do Sylvain Distan, Bernardo Silva, Sergio Aguero, Paul Walsh, Ayle Berkovic, Edin Dzeko, Micah Richards, Carlos Tevez and Craig Bellamy all have in common? Stay tuned to find the answer to that out later on. But first, let's get on with the show. I'm David Mooney, and in today's episode, I am joined by City fan Kieran Murray.
Hello there.
And from The Times, Paul Hurst.
Hello.
Hello. Good to have you back, Paul. Nice to get you on your return from Copenhagen. Kieran, good to hear from you again.
Thank you, David. It's great to be on the show.
I was thinking, because obviously City have been in Copenhagen this week, and Kieran, you're an English teacher. This should fall right in your lap, I think. City have been to Copenhagen, famous for Hans Christian Andersen. We always hear that City, what they're doing is no fairy tale. What would be a good City fairy tale?
Well, thank you for asking that, because it really got me putting my thinking cap on. I've come up with a few. You know that old curse, if a Greek scores a brace on New Year's Day, for the rest of the season, home goals stay away?
Yeah.
There's something, but it's kind of like half fairy tale, half biblical, about Di Michaelis throwing down his ponytail and then getting it all whopped off and losing his powers.
Yeah.
Two, featuring Everton. I thought they found some sort of magic potion at the weekend that stopped them having an injury every 2 minutes when City scored. And then, of course, Sleeping Beauty, featuring Edin Dzeko having a lie down on the turf at Goodison Park. And finally, Mooney Locks and the Three Bears, and that's where David Mooney finally finds a bowl of food that he likes the taste of.
Oh, why are we digging me out here?
Early on. God, shots fired already.
Shots fired.
That was too fussed, wasn't it?
I heard Jack Gawn saying last week that you just don't like flavour, and I thought, right, I'm gonna continue that on. And we found out pre-show you don't drink water either. So
I don't drink enough water is what I said. Not that I don't drink water. I'm not sitting here going, water's too flavourful for me. That's just mental. Yeah, Paul. I we mentioned you've been in Copenhagen. I thought I'd make you feel at home because I thought you might be missing the park and stadium. So just in case, I've prepared this.
Yeah. Very good.
Did we get to the bottom of what that was?
Well, I thought originally when that siren was going off, I thought, you know, has there been some kind of like incident outside, you know, or there's some kind of like mass arrest or something like that. But it must have been, it's one of the away end, sorry, the end, section 12, as they call them, like that's their kind of like firm, as it were, at that end of the ground, are really noisy. And there's a guy at the front who's got like a microphone who's like dictating the crowd and like doing it properly, you know, not like they do in the MLS with the, you know, there's people, you know, like with loud hailers, etc. Yeah. I'm sure that they had some kind of like, some kind of noise that generated that sound of a police siren. It was just a bit alarming, really. I thought it was like, you know, do you remember that last year when City had that boom box, you know, where Grealish walked through the mix zone and he had that boombox after the final. And they got different like buttons, didn't they, that had different sounds on it. It was like a little kind of like disco in a box. And he was like, I'm sure it had a siren as one of those sounds. So I think, maybe it was one of them, but it was all a bit all a bit strange. Yeah, it was all very, very confusing.
Yeah, well, I couldn't tell
whether it was on the match or whether it was coming from outside my home, and the police had finally caught up with my illegal football streaming.
I was going to say I kept checking the windows, thinking, "Oh, there's something going on our road tonight," isn't there? But then there's nothing. Yeah. Right. So let's talk about the actual game. This episode of the Blue Moon Podcast is sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Green King Sport venues are showing every single televised City fixture over the 23-24 season. That means if you can't get to the Etihad for this weekend's game with Chelsea, you can watch it in a Green King Sport pub. And with more than 900 sports pubs across the UK, it doesn't matter where you're based, you can see every single minute of the action. If you download the Green King Sport app, you won't just get 10% off all drinks anytime there's a match on TV, but this month there's also thousands of pints of free Guinness to be won and the chance to win one of six holidays. So let's have a look then at the two games, Everton and Copenhagen. Paul, if Everton was difficult, Copenhagen felt a lot more open and a lot easier. How do you get a handle on what City have done this week? How do you feel they've been playing?
Yeah, I agree that the second match was a lot easier. It was a walk in the park, and as they say.
Oh God!
A journalist on this podcast might have written that in his copy, and somehow it managed to get in the newspaper. I was absolutely astounded that they allowed that one.
Yeah. What are some editors for if they're not going to take out stupid jokes like that? Yeah.
Well, yeah, standards are clearly slipping at the time. But, anyway, I just thought it was one of those Champions League displays where City could have won by about 7 or 8, couldn't they? And they're so good at taking the sting out of the game. I went to Copenhagen for the Man United match earlier this season, and they just collapsed really with all the atmosphere there. They just never looked in control of the game, but City complete opposite. Just kept the ball for the first 10 minutes. Bit like being the nerd that I am, I looked at the touch counter on who scored after about 15 minutes, and Copenhagen had touched the ball about 30 times in the first 15 minutes. They just never had a chance to settle. So it was and how many times have we seen that from City in Europe, particularly away? You know, thinking like the Sevilla match away, it's Sporting Lisbon as well. That was another one, good atmosphere, but they just completely silence the crowd apart from the police siren and took control. So it's pretty much a perfect week for City.
Yeah, I can do that again if we want. It's on the soundboard. I can play
it
all game.
I'm sleep now because of that. I think it's sort of like in my head constantly.
Yeah, there we are. Kieran, I hope it's making you feel at home. If that's the soundtrack to what you listened to the Copenhagen game to, whether it was in the street or on the TV, I hope you're feeling comfortable with it. Just looking at the Everton game, what made that one more difficult, do you think? Was it ultimately just the changes that City have made and Everton's setup?
Yeah, I think so. I thought Everton started pretty well. They were on the front foot, and they'd set up to kind of defuse anything City brought to them. Pep had obviously rotated. De Bruyne, who's been in unbelievable form since he returned, was given a bit of a reprieve. Bernardo didn't start, Walker didn't start. Haaland's finding his way back in. And sometimes it just felt that City were a little bit devoid of ideas, but I do think that came down to Everton's setup and how aggressive they were in times. Plus, as I mentioned earlier, I thought the time wasted marvellously as well. They took the sting out of things, they stopped the momentum, went down injured an awful lot. It was just one of those early kickoffs where it can be a bit turgid, a bit stodgy. As long as we got the 3 points and got out of there, I think that will please everybody. But it wasn't an easy watch by any means.
Yeah, just on the time wasting, I don't know. I haven't thought this through. This might not work. But I did wonder at one point, just after City had scored, and as you said earlier, there was that sort of like magic bullet to Everton's injury suddenly stopping at that point. Mm-hmm. I did wonder if there was a system in place where you could only add on time wasting if the team that had been time wasting were winning or drawing, because then like if you get into that situation, Everton at the end of that game, if the fourth official just comes out and puts up 3 minutes, they go, yeah, but we've wasted all that time. It's like, yeah, but it's your own time you're wasting. This is your good old classic teacher phrase though.
Yeah, they need to think about something instead of this blue card nonsense that they're kind of going ahead with. The time wasting is an issue, and I don't think giant stoppage times of 10 or 12 minutes is the answer that anybody wants, players or fans. I mean, you see that 10 minute go up on the board at the end, and just like, oh, I want to go home now. Especially when the 3 points are essentially in the bag.
At least they put the time up on the clock. There used to be a time when they put 15 minutes up, and we'd all sit there going, how long's that? I don't know.
That's right. Yeah. And I always forgot to set my watch. It was really useful when somebody sitting near you, like, started the stopwatch on them, so you could ask them what was going on. I always just lived in a kind of limbo of not knowing how long was left. It was horrible.
Yeah. Paul, I saw a lot of people suggest for the Copenhagen game that the lineup City put out, as much as they'd rotated for Everton, that the 11 that started against Copenhagen was City's best 11 at the moment. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not convinced by Docker as a starter. I think we're going to come on to that a bit later on, but yeah, I thought that was it's the most balanced team. It's the team that controls the game most, as we know Pep likes to do. So, yeah, I think that is the most, yeah, that, you know, if they play the Champions League final tomorrow, I think that would be, and they're all fit, that would be the team, wouldn't it?
I was going to say Grealish won't be in it if it's tomorrow because he's struggling.
Probably try and hobble back on again, and, you know, I've Pep shouting at him again. But it was good to see Ake at left back. I know he had that good diving header at the end, but he was a bit patchy at times. But I just think he's so much of a better fit at left back than Guardiola. I mean, I look at what, you know, impact we trust and all that, but Guardiola sometimes this season, I just see him like popping up on the left wing on the overlap, and I'm just thinking, you know what, he doesn't look comfortable there. He doesn't create anything there. So why is he there? I was glad to see Ake back in the team and Stones as well. I thought Stones was excellent.
Yeah, let's have a look at Grealish and Doku because I mean we talked there about it was good to see him back even if only briefly. It was a brief reminder of what he can do because he's just not been in the team for a few weeks, Paul. And when you look at kind of that opening 20 minutes, it was a real shame that he ended up having to go off.
Yeah, and we were talking about it after the match, and I was making the point that 20 minutes, that 21 minutes, sort of proved why he should be in the team because he kept the ball well and he was a lot more confident on the ball than I thought he would be. And there's one point where he could have tried to take someone down the wing, but it wouldn't have happened because there's another Copenhagen defender behind and he didn't. He cut inside and found De Bruyne. And he just looked really kind of tidy in his play. So, I just felt so sorry for him when he went down. And you could see that he was so frustrated by it all that, you know, when he came off, he wanted to go back on so to give Doku time to warm up, and Guardiola was like, you know, what are you doing? You know, just stay off and don't make it any worse. But he just wanted another couple of minutes on the pitch. But then when he got on the pitch, he spent those couple of minutes trying to tell his teammates to keep the ball out of play. So it was all a bit weird. I think, you know, to say that he'd not started the last previous five games and he featured very little off the bench in those five games as well. Grealish looked really sharp. I think that obviously we'll wait to see how long he's out for, but if he is fit, I would, towards the end of the season, I would start him ahead of Doku.
Yeah, he's had a difficult season so far, Kieran, hasn't he? It was like that. I guess that kind of adds into the sense of disappointment because it was almost like, okay, you've had some time out of the team, you've had a difficult first half of the season. Go and make this position your own, and then like he just can't do it.
Yeah, it's dead sad on him, and I agree with Paul. I felt really sorry for him on Tuesday night, and I thought it was a really nice sort of juxtaposition to see Grealish come off and Doku come on when it's been. There's been this sort of mumbling and grumbling all year about the difference in between them. And then to see Grealish start so well and Doku's end product is a little bit questionable at the moment. But when he was the kind of almost the symbol of City's celebration in the summer, a bit of alliteration / sibilance for you there.
What was the second one? It's been years since I've done English. It was the alliteration I got. What was...
Sibilance is the repetition of S sounds at the start of words.
Right, I see. Good.
So, as a sort of symbol of all that celebration in the summer, I've done it again.
Show off.
It's really sad to see. Oh God, I can't stop.
Do you know what that noise is?
Sirens.
Yeah.
So many sirens.
We've got background noise in this episode. It's like let me talk.
Oh, that more shots fired then. I see.
to be honest with you, the background noise and let me talk has never bothered me. I don't know what everybody's talking about.
You'll be lucky to come back here soon.
A bit like Grealish. Yeah. So feel dead sorry for him. He looked really good for those first 20 minutes, and there was a real message about what he can do. And last year when he finished the season so strongly, and he was such an emblem of happiness, having won the treble, and to see this season kind of fall a bit flat on its face is just, yeah, it's not nice. But I think it was nice, at least even just for to have a little glimmer of a reminder of what he can do. And hopefully the injury isn't too long and he comes back and we have him for the business end of the season, as they say.
Yeah. Paul, I've seen criticism of Doku's end product this week. Kieran's just mentioned it there, that like it's all well and good getting into positions, like in the Everton game, getting into positions where he's beaten his fullback, but then the ball across doesn't find a City shirt or like you look at the same sort of thing for the Copenhagen game, not quite kind of getting into good positions, but then not delivering. Do we have to remember that, that he is in his first season at City, he's still a raw talent that is being shaped, and at the same time, like his job in the team is not the same as Grealish's job in the team.
Yeah, he's a sort of a, I don't know, he's a completely different player to Grealish, isn't he? He creates chaos, doesn't he? That's his job. And when City signed him in the summer, I was speaking to people who followed his career in Belgium, and they were saying that he's a really, you know, he's a really raw and green player at the moment. His game is purely based on instinct. You know, he will get the ball and drive at goal. And that's obviously contradictory to what we've become accustomed to with Pep. I don't think we've seen that since the days of like early Leroy Sané. So he does provide something different, and he does he needs time to get to know how Pep plays, and you know, to add different dimensions, as they say, to his game. I looked at his stats earlier. He's got 6 assists in 26 matches, so that's not bad. But you're right, when that Everton game on Saturday, he was skinning Godfrey, wasn't he? He did him 2 or 3 times, which is, you know, remarkable. You know, theatre, it's great to watch, but after there wasn't really that much that came of it. So yeah, I think that end product does need working on, but I think he's done a lot better than I anticipated this season, because everyone struggles, don't they? Or everyone has difficulties adapting to how City play in the first year, and to have that record so far is very good, but you know, there's always room for improvement.
Yeah, I tell you, he's not struggling at the moment, Kieran. Not that Doku is struggling, but you know what I mean. It was just a nice little link, and now I've overthought it already at this stage now. And
I'm just a siren. It's a siren in your head.
That's what's going on.
Alarm bells.
But Phil Foden has had a very, very good 2024. He's had a good season so far, but he's been even better since the turn of the year. 6 goals and 2 assists since the turn of the year, which is the same as De Bruyne, but inverted. De Bruyne's got 2 goals and 6 assists. They lead the Premier League's kind of goal involvement metric. And Foden shone in De Bruyne's absence, but he's really enjoying De Bruyne being back as well, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. Did you see his little nod that he gave De Bruyne after after he opened the score in Copenhagen?
That looked like it was on FIFA. And then, it was in real life. I had a moment then when I thought, God, maybe the game's realism has just gone too far. I don't know.
Yeah, he just looked like some sort of proud dad, just nodding his smug approval at what he just witnessed.
His oldest son.
Yeah.
Well done, son.
They're hooking up so unbelievably well. It's so nice to have De Bruyne back, and it's mad. You've just read out his numbers there when he's been absent basically since, you know, game week one, to come back in and be firing those numbers. But Foden's on for one of his best ever seasons, and like numbers wise, but also when you watch him on the pitch, he has just come on leaps and bounds. I mean, obviously we've said that he's a generational talent since the moment really we set eyes on him. And we've been so excited about him for years now. Strange how long he's been around when he's still so young. But he's just absolutely going from strength to strength. And in De Bruyne and Haaland's absence, he kind of put the team on his back a little bit and carried things through. He's so versatile. He's picking up goals and assists left, right and centre from anywhere. And well, he even scored a lovely header the other week. He just keeps adding more strings to his bow at the minute. And he's an absolute joy to watch. What a player.
Yeah. And I mean, Kieran mentioned it there, Paul. It's like, it's not just the numbers. It feels like the whole Guardiola tempo thing. It feels like he gets that now, and he understands what he needs to do at the right time.
Yeah. And if you were, I was just thinking the other day, if you were to have a poll of City's player of the season this year, it'd be him, wouldn't it? I'd say so. And yeah, he's just like you say, he's growing in confidence, and he's getting a better understanding of the game. I think that error against Crystal Palace, that stuck in his mind a lot. You know, when he lost the ball at the end, he gave away the penalty, didn't he? I think that stuck in his mind, and that served as a reminder that he's not done it. He's not got it all yet. And Pep always says that, doesn't he? He's still got to learn to play in the midfield and have a more rounded game. But the way that Pep's been talking about him recently, he's a lot more. He praises him a lot more. He's not with Pep. He used to be that he'd give him sort of a backhanded compliment, as in like, oh yeah, you're playing well. Yeah, it's tough love, you know. Because it's typical, like we say, he's only 23, isn't he? So he's got to learn. He's still in the learning phase of his career. But now it's just full on love from Pep to Foden, and that's as a result of his performances. He controls games, doesn't he? And that wasn't in his armor before. He just used to be a player who relied on instinct to just like pop up around the goal and score. But now he sort of dictates the flow of the game, the tempo as well. So he's just becoming like an all round elite midfielder, and that's obviously as a result as well of how Pep's handled him as well.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the bad stuff though, because there was a little bit of bad stuff, Paul. Talk me through the moment in the stadium where you realised that Edison was just going to pass it straight to their fella.
Well, he's not had one of these for a while, has he? So when the ball came back to her, I thought, you know, this is fine. He'll chip it out to the left back. He'll be fine, and then, you know, before you know it, it's in the back of the net. So, he's not had one of them for, I think it's over a year now. I think it was Spurs the last foul up he did, or last error that led to a goal. So I think we can sort of let him off for this one. And it was, you know, lads, it's Copenhagen. But you know, for the big matches that are coming up, you can't afford to have too many like that. He's probably allowed one a year or something like that, and I think he has improved a lot this season. I know we're talking about clean sheets in a minute, but he's not him who's solely responsible for the lack of clean sheets recently. I think he has. Yeah, it was quite a bad boo boo to commit at that time of the match. But still, you know, City were always going to win that one, weren't they?
Yeah, it's one of them where there's not really a lot to analyse. Sometimes the goalkeeper just shouldn't present the ball to the other team. It's like one of those things, like what more can you say than that? The clean sheets thing is interesting, though, Kieran, because there is a sense, certainly I think among fans, that there is a worry that clean sheets are not being kept. But when I had a look at the stats, they've had 9 clean sheets all season in 34 games, which seems quite low, but 4 of them have come in the last 9. So it kind of suggests that things are getting better slowly over the last few weeks.
Well, I think it's no coincidence that City's good winning run that they tend to go on at this time of year has coincided with better defensive performances, more clean sheets, and
let's not go mad. It's kind of like marginally better defensive performance.
Yeah, true. But I think Diaz seems to have returned to form. Stones is back in the team. Ake is playing unbelievably well. Walker seems to be slowly but surely coming back into a little bit of sense in his form, and then you've got Akanji coming back in. Guardiol has shown glimpses of his potential. And then, yeah, Ederson has a mistake in him sometimes, but is so unbelievably pivotal to how we play, and you can let him off when it comes. When you think last season, our march to treble success was built on basically four centre-backs and a really, really tight defence, you imagine that we will have to build upon these, you know, good, impressive, marginal improvements now. I mean, it is a worry. 9 clean sheets seems very low for a team, you know, who's going for, who's going for glory, basically, in all competitions they're remaining in. So yeah, just hopefully clean sheets become a bit of a foundation to build on now. The goal against Brentford felt a bit of an anomaly, a mad little, you know, kick through the middle, and Mopé seized upon it. The goal against the goal conceded against Copenhagen was obviously, you know, an individual error. In terms of actual defensive performances, I think we've shored things up a lot better, and it's really good to see John Stones back in the side, because him and Diaz, as we know, their partnership at centre back is just has always been great, and always really seemed crucial to defensive improvements going forward.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's finish on Haaland for these two games. A brace against Everton. And Kieran, it's these games you can see where he makes such a big difference, isn't it? Because like City were not playing particularly well, and then a chance falls to him, bang, in it goes.
Yeah, brilliant. My man of the match on Saturday was the steward who told me to hurry up back to my seat because City had a corner, which then they had two corners in a row and they scored from the second one. So I was just back to my seat after rushing to the toilet. So that was really good. And then Haaland was just there. That kind of right place at the right time, powerful finish has just not always been present this year. As much, I know he's been injured for a long period, but it was great to see him backfiring again. It was actually great that Pep had a bit of a word after about his body language too, because obviously with him being out for so long and having not scored on his return up until that point, it was good to have a little bit of reminder to relax and chill out, and it will come eventually. So it was great that one followed another so quickly, and God, he looked good and he looked relieved. And yeah, the crowd absolutely loved it. There's something just really special about a Haaland goal at home.
God, you know it's a bad game, don't you, when the stewards are getting man of the match, Christ.
yeah, true.
Paul, as Kieran said there, like he's not been... We've had this sense last season that when he got put through on goal, he would just score. And you haven't had that same sense of inevitability this season. And then the second goal comes along. It's been a while since he's shown that sort of confidence 1v1. And it's really odd to say that, given the number that he scores.
Yeah, no, I agree. When he went through... I just thought, this is very similar to the West Ham goal, his second goal on debut last season. And he took that goal against West Ham, you know, flawlessly. You never thought he was going to miss. But certainly once he disposed of Branthwaite, which was, you know, I love to see this. hilarious. He was like watching John Alomu run through, wasn't it? You know, see you later, lad. Get down. Knocked him out of the way. As soon as he got, you know, he's one-on-one with the keeper, I would have put it at sort of 60-40 that he would score, but whereas last year you would have given it, you know, 99%, wouldn't you, that he'd score. But he took it really well. And that will, you know, that'll do a lot for his confidence. I mean, that flying kung fu kick or whatever it was on Tuesday in Copenhagen showed that he's got a lot of confidence running through his veins at the moment. I love the first goal against Everton. I also love the Sean Dyche quote afterwards about Haaland not doing trendy goals, not doing the flippers and dippers and chippers or whatever he said. Mm. He just smashed it, and it was a great goal. Both goals were fantastic, and that confidence is slowly getting back to him now. So, and you know, it's like the same with quite a few City players. You know, De Bruyne is gaining his confidence, Stones as well. So that only bodes well for them for the running.
Yeah, and speaking of that second goal, it came just a few days after I'd been wondering on Twitter when City had last scored a classic counter-attacking goal. We'll talk about that shortly, but first, here's the answer to that question I posed earlier on. What do all those players from the intro have in common? They've all scored some of our regulars' favourite goals on the break.
Hi, I'm Dan Burke. And my favourite City counter-attacking goal was Sylvain Distan's at Aston Villa in the 06-07 season.
I'm Joe Butterfield, and I'm talking about the Edin Dzeko counter-attacking goal to make it 6-1 against Manchester United.
It was a midweek game away at Villa Park. We played absolutely brilliantly, absolutely battered Villa. Should have been about 5 or 6-0 up. As it was, we were 2-0 up. Then Villa pull a goal back in the second half and you're thinking, oh God, here we go again.
My name's Chris Higginbottom and I'm a cheeky monkey because I'm shoehorning 3 goals into this soundbite. Even though Mooney only asked for 1.
Julian Lescott in our penalty area, sort of, it feels a bit like a sort of hit and hope, and it kind of is. It's just a sort of lump it, get it long kind of thing, and then comes off a United player who heads it right into, well, I say right into, it's David Silva picks it up perfectly with his first touch.
One point in the second half, Sylvain Distan picks up the ball and played a nice 1-2 with Giorgio Samaras in midfield, and Distan, you know, he was quick, his pace got him out of trouble a lot as a defender, and this time he used it for good effect in an attacking way. He comes herring out of defence, gets on the end of the 1-2 with Samaras and just goes roaring through on goal, and then just has the beautiful composure to slot it past the goalkeeper.
The first one that came to mind was actually in a game where we scored 3 breakaway goals. It was against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in 2010. I mean, it's the ultimate advert for breakaways, apart from if you count the actual chocolate bar advert called a breakaway, which is a really good advert for a not very good chocolate bar.
And then his second touch is just probably the most famous assist of David Silva's entire career, that perfectly weighted through ball to Edin Dzeko, which sends him through one-on-one with De Gea, and with his weak foot, put it right past him to make it 6-1 in that derby, in that game. Wonderful.
Hello, I'm Adam Monk, and I'm a presenter at 442, as well as a Manchester City fan, of course. My favourite counter-attacking goal scored by City over the years has to be Bernardo Silva's against Aston Villa.
The first one of these goals was scored by Carlos Tevez, and it was on the end of one of those up-and-unders where you get people these days shouting hoof, which is annoying. Tevez was onto it in a flash, and he had this weird little scuff shot which just spun it enough for it to toddle around like the flailing hand of Hilario.
Hi, I'm Dom Farrell, and the goal I'm going to talk about is Paul Walsh against Everton in August 1994.
Fernandinho and Mahrez, who were keeping the ball relatively under the cosh in their own box in a very tight space. I think Mahrez poked it out to Fernandinho, and as soon as he did, then he sort of played that long counter-attacking ball down the line to Jesus.
Isn't Hilario something that Bob Mortimer says in his train guy skits?
It was the third goal in a spell of 7 minutes, so it was the first time I think I'd experienced like a ground just going absolutely crackers, and no one really properly sit down from the previous goal, and there's nothing better than the counter-attacking goal for that sort of situation.
He got it into the right area, and it was the fact that the ball didn't bounce or touch the floor. Bernardo just executed it on the side foot, on the volley, roof of the net, past a world-class keeper as well. And it was from back to front in about 10 seconds, and without doubt, the best City counter-attack I've ever seen.
It starts off with Gary Flitcroft sort of welting an Everton corner somewhere close to the moon. Steve McMahon picks it up, sort of worked his way through midfield, rolling back about 10 years because he didn't tend to move like that for City at all, who found Nick Summerby, who sends a first-time ball across the box, and Walsh just stuns his side-footed finish, pings into the net.
I'm Niall from Retro City Goals on Instagram. The Aguero goal from the Napoli game stands out for me for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's the record-breaking goal, making him our leading goal scorer of all time. And secondly, in the context of that game, it was massive.
The second one was a classic breakaway through some vintage Craig Bellamy on the counter, using all of his trademark pace, power and precision. I wouldn't say he was forced wide, he kind of chose to go wide, such was his confidence, and just rifled it into the far corner.
Adam Carter from statcity.co.uk, and my favourite counter-attacking goal is the one we scored in the Division 1 Championship winning season under Kevin Keegan. It was Ayle Berkovic against Norwich.
City end up getting the ball just on the edge of their own box, essentially giving it to Leroy Sané, who ends up picking the ball up on the halfway line, ran through, not past, but through about three players, all of them trying to foul him or bring him down, and then Aguero ends up picking the ball up, edge of the box, and just slots it perfectly past Pepe Reina in the bottom corner.
It was a mad celebration, actually, because he just sort of held his arms like out Christ-like with this kind of really relaxed middle-distance stare, like with the look of a man who had killed and would kill again.
Carlo Nash gathers the ball, and 10 seconds later, the ball's in the back of their net. He throws it to the halfway line. Berkovic majestically takes it down, beats about three players on his way into the box, drops his shoulder as if he's going to come inside, goes back outside, and then megs Rob Green from a ridiculous angle.
He certainly killed Chelsea off with the fourth City goal of the game, which was a really satisfying one.
Hi, I'm Richard Burns, and my favourite City breakaway goal is Edin Dzeko versus West Brom at the Hawthorns in 2012.
Hello, my name's Kieran Murray, and my favourite City counter-attack goal was Sergio Aguero against Arsenal in the League Cup in 2011.
City had gone 1-0 down. Dzeko had come on when he had a bit of a super sub reputation and immediately scored an equaliser. And it was beginning to look like, in the circumstances, a 1-0 draw wasn't such a bad result. And then City won the ball back and it immediately gets played right up the field to Aguero.
I think Arsenal had a corner and De Jong managed to block it. It fell to Dzeko, who then ran like a pacey winger, which I don't ever really remember him doing otherwise, slotted one of those balls through and he kind of stumbled and fell over at the same time, headed through to our number 11 at the time, who then teed up Aguero.
Hi, I'm Casey, and my favourite counter-attacking goal is the one that Micah Richards scored against Blackburn in 2010.
Tevez picks the ball up, simple pass out to Sean Wright-Phillips, who fizzes a daisy cutter across to Bellamy, who just passes it into the net.
Dzeko's bombing down the middle and Aguero plays him in. Dzeko's got all the time in the world to take it towards the keeper, and instead he just goes first time right-footed from 18, 19 yards out and just slots it into the bottom corner.
He ran the pitch with like two touches, and then Benjani hit the post, which it would have been a better goal, but it was funnier that Richards followed it up and tapped it in.
It was one of those where, because of how early he'd hit it, you could see the sort of shape of the shot, that it was about to hit the net. Once it crossed the line, that away end was absolute pandemonium.
And all done in the beautiful classic white shirt with the sash and the We Mean Business black shorts and socks. Fantastic stuff. And Bellamy even managed to slag off John Terry in the post-match interview. Quality.
Hi, it's Nicky Weaver, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
So that was a look at some of our regulars' favourite City counter-attacking goals. And I want to talk about the counter-attack in a little bit more depth now, because I don't think City's relationship with counter-attacking is a normal one. I think City turned down more counter-attacks than probably any other team in favour of keeping the ball, building up with passes, that sort of thing. Have a listen to this. This is Guardiola speaking after the Copenhagen game about how he uses passes to stop the other team getting ahead of steam and stop the fans in away grounds especially getting their tails up.
This type of games, if you want to attack quicker than expect, they make a transition that you suffer a lot. And we want to make a right tempo, no slow, no fast, to make the this incredible stadium, the people are behind. So that's low. I had the manager when I said, okay, when you start in a big, big stadium with a lot of crowd and shout and the pressure, make 1,000 passes. It's not allowed to score a goal, just passes. And the stadium is go down.
And that was from Tuesday night. And then it kind of struck a chord in my head because I've remembered this from December 2021. This is Guardiola after a 1-0 win over Wolves. Wolves were down to 10 men at the Etihad. And this was the first season that fans were back in the ground and it had been comfortable in the game up until the closing stages. That was when the fans were urging the team to go on and try and score the second, and City kept giving up possession of the ball by trying to counter-attack. This is what Guardiola said afterwards.
When you want to win 0 and still to control, we start to run up and down. So we lost simple balls. 4 or 5 simple balls, that is not necessary. And we break in this situation because we play at home, because demanding the people, and when that happens, you lose the balls, easy balls, and after the counter-attack. So we concede actions because we let them play when we have one more player. It's almost man-to-man.
Now, Paul, I do wonder if all of this kind of comes back round to that Guardiola thing of you've just got to do it right. Whatever you do, you've just got to do it right. Because obviously none of this, and Everton is the case in point, City are not going to go, don't counter-attack. It just means kind of like counter-attack at the right time and in the right way. And that's kind of why I think that second against Everton is quite interesting, because like, I don't think many players in a Guardiola team would, like De Bruyne wouldn't play that ball through unless it's Haaland running onto it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's the point, isn't it? No one understands the way that Pep wants to play the game better than De Bruyne. You know, they think very similarly, and he knows that Haaland's going to, you know, there's a very good chance that Haaland's going to score that goal. So I think if you would have had a, you know, if there had been 4 or 5 defenders on him, he would have probably like put his foot on it and played it sideways or just kept the ball. So Pep trusts De Bruyne in particular, and well, most of the players really, to understand how he wants them to play the game. And I did think that on Saturday that he's that there would be obviously a lot of added time, as we were saying, but I didn't really ever think that Everton were going to, you know, get a chance to score against City. So I think it was definitely worth a counter attack, worth taking on. And as you were saying, and as Pep said, he doesn't want them not to counter attack. He wants them to choose the right moment to do it. And I think certainly that was a case where it was the right call.
Yeah, it sounds really harsh as well, Kieran, because when you think back to that Wolves game and De Bruyne trying to play the ball through, he's playing it through to Sterling and Jesus and not a player like Haaland, who, as much as we talked earlier on about Haaland maybe not feeling as inevitable that he was going to score as it did last season, like you always had that sense with Sterling and Jesus that they might miss this.
Well, going back to Paul's point about it probably being 60-40 that Haaland would score on Saturday, when it was Jesus and Sterling, you'd probably put it at 20-80, you know, that they would, to, you know, depending on their form and circumstances. So there was a much more likely chance of getting turned over and allowing the team to regain some control and to go at us, and we were all over the place. It was just a bit messier then. De Bruyne and Haaland can just be so tidy in how they counter-attack. And, I mean, I completely forgot about it in the feature. One of my favourite City goals of all time, the Bernardo goal against Villa, like, that there couldn't be a more crisp, tidy counter-attack. So when it is the right time and you can do it, and the opposition stretched so much the way it is because they're piling on the pressure themselves, it makes sense to go that way. So yeah, it is all about just, we know this word, control. It's all about just control the right time. And talking earlier about Foden, I think he's the kind of epitome of a player who has grown into realizing when going is too quick, too sudden and too ill-timed to when, you know, the right time is. And I think his maturity and maturing over the last few seasons is kind of, he like many of us have been kind of pep-pilled, I guess, into understanding when's the right time to go and when's the right time to wait.
Yeah, I mean, you say that though, but you do hear a lot of cries in the crowd when, you know, when the opposition have attacked and they've been in a low block for, I don't know, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, whatever. They've had everybody behind the ball. They get a corner, they move everybody forward, and City keep possession as they clear it. You hear a lot of cries of get it forward, they're all out of position. And you watch then as City just go, no, we're going to keep the ball, and it might let them get back into shape and everything else. But it's because we feel safer doing this. We think we can break you down doing this, whereas we don't want to give you the chance to catch us out of position. And like, do you understand that frustration sometimes from the fans?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure I've been there myself. You go and you pay your money and you want to be entertained and you want to see as many goals as possible, and so there will be a clamour in the stadium, and you know, all fans want more and more goals, but you know, all the fans who are screaming aren't Pep Guardiola, with Pep Guardiola's understanding of the game and his demands and his, you know, what he wants.
Anxiety about how the game could go wrong, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always think, and I've mentioned this in the podcast before, but I always think a massive turning point in Pep's City career was the Leicester 5-2 defeat during the lockdown season. I think he made some strange substitutions that day. We were counter-attacked left, right and centre. He realised that kind of under the laboratory conditions of behind closed door football, that he could, you know, basically train City up to make games. Some of the games in those behind closed doors days were dark dirges, really, weren't they? Where nothing really happened and it was just about control. The shackles were on. But I think Pep used that as a kind of transitional time where he recognised what it meant to control games, and he recognised what it meant to get 3 points without always the glitz and glamour of huge big score lines. And don't get me wrong, we score plenty of goals still, but control comes first, and that's just been one of the secrets to success over the past few seasons, I think.
Yeah, and I think, Paul, that's probably why I feel like City are coming into form right now, because you think back to the autumn and winter, City couldn't control a game. And then you watch like the Brentford game, for instance, the number of counter-attacks they turned down in order to be able to control the game, it just felt like they could see the bigger picture again.
Yeah, and it's that the thing is, when they've got, even if they allow teams to get back and get into their shape, they've got the players. City have got the players that can then pick them apart, and that's, you know, that's what they do, isn't it? If you've got players like, you know, De Bruyne and Foden on the edge of the box, and really precise passes, and people that like that are accustomed to playing in small spaces like Bernardo Silva, they're just as good at, well, they're even better at scoring goals from against teams that have a lower block than they are on the counter attack, just because they're used to it. You know, because 90% of the games, particularly at home, the opposition will just sit deep. So City, you know, will end up picking you apart if you sit deep. So it's not much of a problem, really. I do think that, you know, the opposite of that, and again, because I cover Man United, it's they have no control sometimes at United. It's one end to the other. And, you know, the Copenhagen games for each team showed that. The United game was completely all over the place, and that's why they lost 4-3. You know, it was just, they have no control on the game whatsoever, whereas City were happy to, you know, to buy the time and pick Copenhagen apart. So I think that's one of the, you know, that's the reason why they're not always helter-skelter counter-attacking team. It just doesn't work for them, and they don't need it.
Yeah, it's interesting, the Copenhagen thing as well, because I don't know if you saw this, but right before City scored the third goal, obviously Haaland had that chance where he got into the box and been played through. And as the ball broke back to City, it came to Rodri, and he was signalling with his hands. He did that big, massive hand signal of, look, nothing stupid here, keep it, everything really, really tight. Almost like get out of there with the 2-1 instead of potentially risking the 2-2. And then still in that kind of mode of, if the chance comes, though, you have to take it. The chance opened up down the right-hand side and they took it. And it's almost like having the best of both worlds. I don't know.
Yeah, and it comes back to what we were saying earlier. If the opportunity is there and it's the right opportunity to take, then take it. And to be fair, I think it was Nunes, wasn't it, who started the move on the right-hand side. He took someone on, and then, you know, two or three passes later, you've got that opportunity and Foden scores. So I can see why Rodri was thinking that, but equally, if you get an opportunity and it looks the right one, then take it. I certainly don't think that, you know, Copenhagen would have ploughed forward on the counter attack and got an equaliser. You know, they've not played for 2 months, so they were absolutely knackered by the end, weren't they? So, but you know, you can see why Rodri was thinking that. I mean, again, talking, you know, thinking about players who understand and see the game the same way as Pep, then Rodri's certainly one of those.
Well, let's have a look now to the coming games with Chelsea and Brentford. We'll start by hearing about this weekend's opposition. I've been speaking to The Athletic's Chelsea correspondent Liam Toomey to find out how things have been going at Stamford Bridge lately.
Chelsea felt like a team that would raise or lower their level to the standard of the opposition. So they really got themselves up for the big home games. They played Arsenal, they played Liverpool, they played City really well at Stamford Bridge and ended up getting draws from all of those games and having stretches where they looked like the better team. But in between, you had these limp defeats to low blocks and a kind of existential crisis around the club, with fans really disconnected from the strategy of the owners and disconnected from this squad of players, most of whom they haven't known very long and who are very young and very inconsistent, finding their way, most of them. And a manager who, you know, they haven't had much connection to, obviously hasn't been at the club very long and has had a long association with Tottenham, which didn't help. So it's been a funny season at Chelsea, and the league position has been, particularly in recent weeks, the cause of significant angst and introspection about where the Pochettino project is going. And I think those back-to-back losses against Liverpool and Wolves with 8 goals conceded, those were really alarming performances. The Wolves won more so than Liverpool, which was maybe explicable in the circumstances with Klopp announcing his departure and Anfield being this cauldron of emotional intensity, which it can be. But Chelsea have also shown at times this season, every time they've looked in danger of completely spiralling, they produce a response, they get back on their feet. The Villa performance was really genuinely impressive, maybe their best of the season, actually, I think, in terms of a 90-minute performance. And then Palace was almost a microcosm of their season. Really bad first half, contrived a way to fall behind and managed to fix it in the second, but in a way that left no one totally convinced by them.
Yeah. Are you starting to see signs that Pochettino is kind of creating an identity of this Chelsea team?
I think there have been signs for most of the season, actually. They've just been quite scattered and rarely delivered in the form of a full performance, let alone a string of performances. But unlike last season, when I think Graham Potter quite quickly lost faith in the idea that he arrived with, and then the squad became a mess in January and the whole season kind of unravelled from there. From the start of this season, it's been quite clear what Pochettino is trying to do tactically, the style that he wants Chelsea to play. The variance has been in their execution, really. And I think the other thing that explains how slowly things have developed or at times not developed for Chelsea this season has been the injuries. They've had more or less 10 players out all season, and that's finally beginning. Well, that was finally starting to ease, and now you've got Thiago Silva out, Benoit Badiashile. We can talk about this, but they've got a little bit of a defensive injury crisis heading into this game. So he's never had anything approaching a full squad to pick from, and that's included some key players out. We're only just starting to see Christopher Nkunku, for example, who was bought as to be the marquee attacking name. So Chelsea still do feel a work in progress, and a lot of that has been a product of the circumstances. But there has been a feeling all the way through of what Pochettino wants to do, and at times we have seen it and it's looked pretty good.
Yeah. In terms of, I mean, you mentioned earlier about Chelsea raising their game according to the opposition at home. How's that been away? Has it been a similar sort of story away, or has it been a completely different one?
Well, leaving aside the Tottenham away game, which I think stands alone for the crazy circumstances and tactics.
Quite, yeah.
I've never seen a game like that. they've had some really dark away days. You know, Newcastle away comes to mind. Manchester United was really, really poor. Liverpool, we already mentioned. They're not the most resilient bunch. They're a very young team. And while they have produced responses from game to game, a bad performance followed by a good performance, within games, if things start going against them, particularly against a good team, errors can cascade and it can get quite ugly. And they struggle to get a grip on themselves. And I think that's the biggest worry against the team, as talented and as ruthless as City are. Because, and we've spoken about this when you've had me on before, I've always got the feeling that City as a club, whether the fans feel this is another thing, City as a club really enjoy putting the hurt on Chelsea when they get the opportunity. I do get that sense. And from the way that their team has approached that game at home, there have been so many, I'm doing the trip again this weekend, there have been so many miserable Chelsea trips to the Etihad in recent years where they've taken every opportunity to really run up the score and really dominate them as completely as possible. And I could easily see that happening to this Chelsea team. If they concede early and City jump all over them, you've got a full-powered Haaland, you've got Kevin De Bruyne back, you know, it could get really ugly for this team. It has been a different story away from home, but they do have the talent to make it more competitive.
Yeah, when it comes to Chelsea coming to the Etihad for this one, how do you see Pochettino approaching it? Because he doesn't seem like someone who is going to kind of try and neutralise City, in the sense that a lot of teams try and neutralise City by getting men behind the ball and sitting deep. It looks like it feels like he's the sort of manager to try and press them.
Yeah, I mean, there have been variations within his system, but the system has remained the same. Some games Chelsea have sat a bit deeper and been a bit more conservative. I think Villa away, they kind of boxed a bit more clever. They didn't push high immediately. They let Villa come onto them and press them. And then when they had the opportunity in the game to pin Villa back and play in their half, they took it and pressed high and forced them into high turnovers. So situationally, if they have an opportunity to try and put City under pressure high up the pitch and really attack, then they'll take it. But if they have to defend as well and counter-attack, I think they'll be reasonably happy to do that as well, because they actually, week to week, haven't had many opportunities to play against teams that give them space to run into. And that was one thing that was really marked about the first game, was that both teams had so much space to run into. It felt like the whole game was played in transition. I don't think this game will be like that. I might be wrong. I don't think it will be quite as open as that.
Do Chelsea like that, though? Because I know City don't like that. City don't like the transitions. They much prefer to try and control it and pin another team back. Are Chelsea the sort of team that can exploit somebody on the transition?
Well, I think Chelsea like to have control in possession, and that comes from the midfield. You know, Enzo and Caicedo are players that really want to be on the ball. They want to dictate things. They want to play at their pace if possible. But Chelsea also have a lot of fast attacking players who like to be very direct, either running without the ball or running with it. And someone like Cole Palmer, you have a guy who likes to play those high risk, high reward passes to spring people through. So I think they do like having those opportunities against scrambled defences, because the thing they've struggled most with this season, Chelsea, and you saw it in the first half against Crystal Palace, if they're confronted by a disciplined low block that doesn't give them any easy avenues, they very quickly run out of ideas and lose all confidence in what they're doing, and the tempo goes out of their play, and you just get these long langers of Chelsea possessions that go nowhere. Whereas if a team comes onto them and presses them but doesn't quite press them so well that they can't get out, then they kind of have more of an idea of where to go and what to do. And in players like Palmer, in Nkunku, who we'll see whether he starts this game, I think that's one of the biggest questions that Pochettino has, they have guys who are better at making decisions in those situations and picking the right passes.
Yeah. Finally, Liam, how do you think this one's going to go at the weekend? We've got the charity bet. So what score do you think we'll go for? And how do you see the performance going for Chelsea?
I mean, Chelsea to me are the chaos factor in this game, because we really don't know what to expect from them week to week these days. But I do know, or at least I feel like I've got a pretty good idea what to expect from City. They're chasing a title. They're, as you said, they've got pretty much a clean bill of health now, and they seem to have a real focus to them. So I think they'll win this game. They'll be the stronger, more ruthless team. And over the course of 90 minutes, Chelsea will make mistakes. They always do. And City are very well equipped to punish them. So I would say maybe 3-1 City.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was The Athletic's Liam Toomey. Kieran, 9 wins in a row for City now. Is this a run? Can we call it one of those runs now? Or do they have to prove themselves against the teams that caused them problems back in the autumn? So like Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool.
It is a run, but I don't think we can call it one of those runs until it's over or it comes to an end or there is some sort of fruition from it. It's really healthy what's happening at the moment. Everybody, well, I know there were a few injuries against Copenhagen, but a fully fit squad, everybody seems to be firing. The ideas seem to be seeping through. Key players are back and doing really well. So we do have the potential and all of the kind of factors are coming together in a perfect storm that suggests it could turn into one of those runs. But when you look at the fixture list, Chelsea causes massive problems earlier this season. And then we have to go to Spurs and Liverpool, two of the absolute biggest bogey grounds imaginable. So if we get through them somehow, we can definitely call it one of those runs and it will be integral.
How have you pronounced the word integral in two different ways without using the pronunciation of integral? I don't know.
It's just one of those that I always get wrong in my head. Like it sounds wrong to what I envision it looking like in my head. You know,
just use another word. Like you could have picked any other word, and you went, "No, I'm going to go the one I'm not sure how to say."
But I'm trying to impress your listenership, David. With there's a Times journalist on here too. But I fucked it up.
But he's making puns about parking. So like we're fine. Eh?
Yeah, sorry, I can't remember what my point was. I think I should have just used the word vital, probably.
Yeah,
important. Yeah.
Important. Yeah. Paul, how much do you expect the team to change? I mean, obviously, Grealish is probably going to be out. Bernardo might be out after that kick he took on Tuesday. But ultimately, we talked about that being potentially City's best 11. It feels like a run of fixtures now where they're going to need as many of that team in the starting 11 as possible, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, obviously, Grealish, you'd expect him to miss out. I think Bernardo will play. He's one of those players who... I mean, it was quite a nasty kick, but he was sort of... he's one of those players that will, you know, that will play through pain, won't he? Yeah.
And he's integral to how City play.
He is. He's very important. Yeah. I don't think I'm able to get that out of my head now. I might start pronouncing that way. Maybe you started something here, Kieran. You know, maybe this is the start of the change of the English language, right?
Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd imagine that Alvarez had come in. There haven't been many games where Alvarez hasn't featured. I mean, he didn't even come off the bench, did he, on Tuesday? So I imagine he'd play. He's a bundle of energy. So I imagine he'd probably come in alongside De Bruyne in midfield. Maybe, you know, use Foden and Doku on the wings, or Bernardo. So yeah, he's got loads of, even with the injuries that they've got, he's got loads of different players he can bring in, particularly. In, you know, you look at the defence as well. Kanji could play as well. So he probably just needs to make a couple of changes. But there's so many. I think as long as he's got two of De Bruyne, Foden, and Silva in the team, they become a lot. That's enough creativity in the team by a long shot. I mean, last Saturday when I saw that you got Kanji stepping into midfield alongside Rodri, and then you got Nunes and then Alvarez, and that there were you. In essence, your midfield four, I thought that's there's absolutely zero creativity there. So, yeah, I think they need to have at least, you know, like I said, two of De Bruyne, Silva and Foden in the team.
Yeah. How much pressure can be put on De Bruyne, Paul, after his injury? Because he's going to be needed over this next month or so. And then, but at the same time, he's kind of, they've been really careful managing him. And then in the last few weeks, he just kind of started every game apart from Everton.
Yeah, I think they still will use him sparingly. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't start the Brentford game, for example. They are wary of causing him another injury. He's just, how old is he? He's 32, 33 now, and he's had a run of injuries, so I don't think he can play, you know, two or three times a week. And they, obviously, it's weird saying this because he's the best midfielder in the world, but they don't essentially necessarily need him in every match just because of how Foden's playing. You know, like we were saying earlier, Foden flourished in De Bruyne's absence. And when he's, you know, I don't think they necessarily need to play him in every match. And I think De Bruyne probably, despite the fact that he's a, you know, he's a bit of a warrior, he will understand that. He's a very intelligent guy. He knows that he's limits these days. He's a very fit player, but to have another one of those injuries, you know, another 4 or 5 months would be really detrimental to him. So, yeah. So I think he knows he's got to take it steady as well.
Yeah. Kieran, on the flip side, you mentioned that 4-all at Stamford Bridge. Pochettino teams seem to be able to do this to City. They seem to cause problems for Guardiola. And I'm wondering if this is going to be a difficult game for City to control on that basis.
Yeah, he brings the chaos factor, doesn't he? It was interesting listening to the preview that Liam said that City seemed to really like, you know, going on the attack on Chelsea and really giving it to them. Because that has been true in the past couple of seasons.
But I wasn't sure if it's just because they play one step beyond at the end of the game when they've won that.
Yeah.
That was funny, though.
Oh, it's amazing. I absolutely love that. Yeah, so, but yeah, it is just that kind of like high press, and he's a good progressive tactical manager, Pochettino. Chelsea, as you know, has been well documented, are a bit of a chaos team, lacking identity, and it's hard to predict and put your finger on what's going on with them from week to week and game to game. But you always know they'll be up for it against City, and you always know Pochettino versus Pep will be a bit of a, you know, a bit of a strategical, tactical chess match, really, but with, you know, a mad chaos factor in there too. I hope City will be able to control this one better, and I hope he will have learned. You get the feeling that 4-4 would just be Pep's absolute nightmare. Like, that it would send shivers down his spine to think about a result like that. So not even coming away from with the 3 points. It's just, yeah, so you imagine we will, and with the players back and with the way we've been playing lately, you imagine there will be a much greater kind of studs on the ball, foothold in the game, avoid that kind of crazy turnovers. And yeah, hopefully be able to do what we did against the likes of Brentford, where all of a sudden we're just passing around in triangles over the halfway line and suddenly spotting open and then we're in. And yeah, it's nice that players like De Bruyne and Haaland are back, firing fit, and hopefully we'll be able to do that and take the 3 points on Saturday.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I mean, you mentioned before about the defenders coming back into form, and I wondered how much of the control of this game will fall down to the fact that they didn't have Stones in the away game. So like the Stones Diaz partnership is back, Kieran, and that's been a big thing this last few weeks.
Yeah, and with the Stones Diaz partnership comes the kind of Stones Rodri partnership. You know, it's a really refreshing position that John Stones has managed to hold down, where he can, you know, he can drift forward. I think I saw Paul in your article, Stones' touch map against Copenhagen, and he was just everywhere, not where you would expect a central defender to be. So it's amazing having a player with such versatility there, because obviously he can bring control into the back four, but, you know, he exerts his control all over the pitch and knits everything together so nicely. So it's great that he's back, and hopefully he can stay fit until the end of the season, because he is an integral part of City setup.
Well done, well done. I love seeing touch maps of John Stones when you lay out the pitch, Paul, because it always looks like the pitch has caught like chicken pox or something, just with where all these dots are. Just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's like someone's dragged. It's like a cursor on your computer, and he's sort of dragged across the match across the pitch. It's he's sort of like. It plays in the like number 10 position on the left hand side and the right, and it's just yeah. just crazy. And thank you for it's good to know that people are actually reading my copy, Kieran.
Yeah, because we found out earlier the sub editors aren't, so
well, your fiver's in the post, don't worry. but yeah, it's I think, yeah, Stones is just he's in the article again, not wanting to big myself up too much, but I was talking about that. The Akanji quote after the Champions League final about him playing like Maradona, which, you know, is a bit of a stretch, but when he
punches that ball into the net, will be
when he's talking about eight players and then palmed it in. He makes such a big difference, doesn't he? When he's there and he can step into midfield, and they've tried so many different options in his absence. They've tried Akanji stepping into midfield, and for me, that's, you know, that said sirens going off in my head whenever I see him.
Hang on, I can do it. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, Akanji on the ball. Yeah, woo, yeah. Get rid. Yeah, give it to Rodri. Yeah, and then they've had, like I say, Guardiola down the left, and then Walker on the overlap. Walker's tried tucking in a little bit as well. Just none of them work compared to John Stones. He's the best at tucking into midfield and advancing the ball. And you'll see him, like, on Tuesday, for example, you look at the I think it was the second goal, you look at his position there, and he's just sort of like loitering on the edge of the area or 10 yards from the edge of the area. So he's not only waiting for a pullback, but he's also the first line of defence if they start a counter-attack. So he's... like I say, he understands positionally, he understands that role perfectly. So, yeah, as long as he stays fit for the rest of the season, he will be an integral part of the team.
let's have a quick word on Brentford. That's coming up before the next podcast as well. And Kieran, I'm a little bit when I sat down to plan this, I was just kind of like, what on earth do you say? We played him like 20 minutes ago. Like, what's changed? Is there actually any kind of advantage or disadvantage to playing a team so soon after you've just played them? Because like surely Guardiola will look at it and go, well, they're not going to do the same thing again, so we'll have to do something different. But then Thomas Frank might go, they'll think we're going to do something different. So if we do something the same, that'll catch them. And I'm tying myself up in knots over this.
Yeah, who'd be a football manager, really? But it is kind of nice to know that we beat them so comfortably away from home. It is also nice that they clearly had a strategy worked out for how to attack us with that long ball down the middle. So hopefully we're a little bit more attentive to those kind of things. But yeah, like when you think last year, they beat us home and away. The year before, it was a little bit, were they both 1-0s?
Grim. They were grim though, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So having that little bit of confidence now that we can take it to Brentford, beat them comfortably and kind of just like wipe them away, hopefully will be the way we'll go about it on Tuesday night. Haaland hasn't scored against Brentford yet either, and with him getting back into the scoring way of things against Everton, it might be nice. Hopefully his body language is nice and positive and he can notch one up against them, because I think they're one of the only sides he hasn't scored against yet in the league. Is that right?
Yeah. Just on that, I'd get Foden into your fantasy league team, Paul, because he's scored 71% of all of City's Premier League goals against Brentford.
Well, there you go. Yeah, he's Pep always said about him, doesn't he, that he's got a sort of scent for goal. He says he can sniff the goal, which is always a bit, you know, a bit of a strange thing to hear.
Doesn't translate, does it? Yeah,
yeah. No, one of them where you sit in the room and you think, yeah, I know what you mean, but it sounds a bit dodgy. But yeah, no, he's got that instinct, hasn't he, of being in the right place at the right time, and he's like we were saying earlier, his confidence is through the roof at the moment. And, you know, he fully deserved that hat trick, didn't he, at Brentford? And you know, he'll be he'll definitely be in the team at the moment for that game and the Chelsea game. You just can't take him out at the moment, can you? He's got such self belief, and I think that'll be as long as they stick to the plan, they'll beat quite comfortably.
Yeah. Well, let's get some predictions on the board. We had a winner on last week's show. Adam Keyworth successfully predicted City's 3-1 win in Copenhagen. That means we've now collected £800 on this season's charity bet so far. All the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're outside the Etihad before weekend home games collecting for Manchester Central Food Bank. They'll be back on Saturday under the bridge near Asda from around about 3 p.m. William Hill is giving us three £10 correct score singles, and the winnings are going to the group's funds. We heard earlier on that Liam has gone for a 3-1 City win at the weekend. That's 10-1 and £100 if he's right. Paul, what are you having for this?
4-1.
4-1 City is 18-1 and £180 if you are right. Kieran, over to you, mate.
3-2 to City.
3-2 City. Not much. Doesn't sound like there's much control in that one, mate.
I've just undone every single thing I've said in the podcast.
Yeah, but if it happens, though, and there's another controlless game that City win 3-2, it's 25-1 and £250 if you are right. Moving over to Brentford then on Tuesday, I've gone for a 1-0 City win. That's 17-2 and £85. Kieran?
2-1 to City.
2-1 City is 9-1 and £90. And Hursty, over to you to finish.
3-1 to City.
3-1 City is 10-1 and £100 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org. We will finish this week by squeezing in a quick listener question. Get in touch on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us as well. Fill in the form on bluemoonpodcast.com. That's what George has done. He says, Bernardo's goal has been described as lucky by so many in the media. It was a lucky bounce, but it still needed finishing. I want to hear your memories of when City have been genuinely really, really lucky. And I've chucked in unlucky in there because I, as a fan, I start to think, Kieran, that we just, like, all the moments of good luck, we just go, well, they deserve that. And we just kind of bank it as like things that haven't been lucky. And then the moments of bad luck, we go, God, that was unlucky.
Yeah. There's been some, that's a great question because it really properly gets you thinking. There's been some lovely moments of luck. I mean, If you watch it again, it still gives me heart palpitations. But John Stones' clearance off the line against Liverpool, where the ball kind of bounced and bounced and bounced off, and it was heading in, and he just managed to get it off. Aguero, do you remember Aguero's goal against Burnley, where it kind of, there were two players on the line?
Oh, how could you forget this goal?
Oh, a really tight angle, and it kissed the near post.
That's not even the goal I'm thinking of. That was at the Etihad, wasn't it? He hit the inside of the near post and then it went in on the far side.
Incredible.
The one I was thinking of was that same season at Turf Moor, Aguero's second goal. I think it was one of them where Burnley failed to clear it about three times. And then there was one moment where two Burnley defenders cleared each other.
Yes.
And then it fell to Toure, who I think fell over trying to get it to Fernandinho, who slipped on the byline and got it across. And then it hit Aguero on the knee and went in. And I think Guardiola afterwards was asked about the quality of the goals. And he's just going, beautiful goals. Beautiful goals.
Yeah. Do you remember Aguero's penalty against Everton in 2013 where it came off the post, hit Tim Howard on the head, and then went back into the net?
Yeah. Yeah, I ate them. As a keeper, I ate them.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
Yeah. Paul, anything that sprung out to you, any moments of good fortune that we, with our kind of blinkers on, we can't see?
Well, I always think of the Rodri handball against Everton in February 2020.
No, they checked it, mate. It was fine. He didn't handball. Yeah.
Well, I checked it again this morning back on YouTube, and it looks even worse than I remember at the time. He's the least natural position I've ever seen anyone like. I mean, he just moves. He clearly moves his arm towards the ball inside the penalty area, and I can't believe how they got away with that one. And as a funny aside to that, I remember one of my friends getting that actual moment printed in a T-shirt, like the frame of that handball, just to antagonise any other, you know, Liverpool fans or any United fans or whoever, Everton fans. just because it was so blatant. Such a massive handball.
I used it on the podcast promo for the next season. I used that image and described the podcast as City Analysis expertly handled.
You look at the while they're reviewing it, while the referees, you know, they've stopped the corner or whatever it is, and the referee's got his, you know, listening to the VAR. Rodri is just like, he's like shouting at Bernardo for some reason. He's almost like, oh, you made me do this, you know.
I remember chatting in our WhatsApp group, Kieran, basically. I think I was watching on live TV and everybody else was on a stream or on demand. So they were like, they're a couple of seconds behind. And I was like, yeah, they're going to give this. There's no way they're not going to give this.
Yeah. It's terrifying. Because I was in London. I was coming home on the train, just checking every 2 seconds. Yeah, I thought, I really feared the worst, but I think we got a stroke of good luck in that game as well with how the goal went in. It sort of fell lovely for Foden, and like kind of ricocheted through a few Everton players, and then Foden was just there to like side foot it in. It was amazing. In terms of bad luck, I love thinking about Sheffield United's assist off a balloon in 2008.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
The one said he could manage that.
I always think of one years and years earlier. City lost 4-1 at Main Road to Charlton, and the fourth goal is Richard Dunn on the halfway line just clears it into Klaus Jensen. And it goes all the way back the other end and lobs Nicky Weaver and drops into the net. And the fella, like it's one of them where like it must be in the air for about 5 or 6 seconds. That's the distance it's travelled. It really takes an age to get from the halfway line to the goal. And Weaver's obviously outside of his box, scrambling back to try and get in. And I just, as it was on its upward trajectory, there was a fella that sat in front of me at Main Road who I've lost touch with, actually. We used to be in touch with him, but then like as the years gone by, we've lost touch. So maybe you're listening to this, Chris, I don't know. But it just in a completely deadpan voice just went, it's in. And then it was like 3, 4, 5, crosses the line now. And it's just like, how have you seen that coming? It's such a deadpan way. But yeah, it's like, go and have a look on YouTube. It's a terrible goal to concede. But yeah.
Company's own goal against Fulham is always a classic as well. We're just talking about something looping up in the air and there's no way you think that's going in. And then all of a sudden, I think Jesus Navas tries to jump up and clear it. Joe Hart kind of leaves it to Navas. And then it's nestled in the back of the net. That's pretty mad.
So if we've missed out your favourite moments of good or bad fortune for City, let us know at Blue Moon Podcast on Twitter. Email us your questions as well for next week, bluemoonpodcast.com, fill in the form. But for now, that's the end of this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one. Kieran Murray.
Thanks, I've learned a lot.
You have indeed. And Paul Hurst.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I've learned a lot as well. A lot of stuff about pronunciation and the use of police sirens in podcasts as well.
Yeah, there we go. I would play it, but we've already got the outro music going, so I'm not gonna interfere with that. If you'd like to listen to more, then there are extra nostalgia shows on our Patreon page every Monday. There's a clip of this week's coming up shortly. That was a look back over good and bad games against Portsmouth with Adam Carter and Portsmouth fan and commentator Ian Dark. Go and check it out. I'll be back next week to review the games with Chelsea and Brentford. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
They were 8 points adrift of safety, then Manchester City at home. If they didn't win that game, basically, I think the view from Harry Redknapp and everyone was Pompey are dead and buried. It was nearly the last kick of the game. Pedro Mendes was one of three players that Harry brought in, typical Harry, as like a job lot from Spurs. The winner was a smashing strike with the outside of the foot into the corner of the net, and they went on to get 20 points out of the last 30 available and pulled off this amazing Houdini escape with a game to spare.
Adam, do you know how many City got in the remaining 30 available?
Go on. Three. I know we had a better...
Three.
I know we had a better start to that season than the end when we had like Cole and Vassell up front at the beginning of the season.
There have been some great escapes from the Premier League. I remember West Brom pulling off one, but this was one of the superb ones.
Do you know who kick-started that West Brom one as well?
I'm trying to think of that.
That was City that year that that kick-started that one. And then when Roy Hodgson did the Great Escape with Fulham, that was City that kick-started that one. It seems to be if you're in trouble in the Premier League, get City in and they can kick-start a Great Escape.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.